Gettysburg Seminary presents the Seminary Explores podcast. Conversations on faith, art, people, politics, theology, life, and more. With voices from around the corner and around the globe.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to the podcast, Seminary Explores here at Gettysburg Seminary. I'm Kristen Largen, and I'm delighted to have with me another guest from Gettysburg College, Dr. Richard Russell, Associate Professor of Psychology. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you.
Well, I have to say, I want the listeners to know, because I think this is such a great story. So the way I had come across your work, of course, was there was a New York Times article. Was it about a month ago
now? Something like that, yeah.
That was talking about this phenomenon of super recognizers, and it was referencing a policeman, actually, in London, who has this capacity to, better than a computer, recognize faces, and the article was very interesting. I mean, we all know people who are on the other end of the scale who have a hard time recognizing faces, but here's somebody at the other end, again, you know, even more than a computer. And I saw your name in Gettysburg College, and I thought, oh, isn't that great? And so we were in contact, and so I thought it'd be fun to just have a conversation kind of about your work. So we'll get to that. But first, I just would like to hear a little bit about how you got into psychology and how you got to this position and kind of developed your current areas of research.
Uh-huh. Well, in terms of psychology, I was really interested at the same time in the mind and our experience and, you know, why is life, a lot of these sort of big questions,
yeah,
that people in, you know, theology are,
right,
are certainly interested
right,
in, right? But I kind of was attracted to the sciences at the same time, and I think that's kind of where I landed, and initially in neuroscience when I was an undergraduate,
okay,
and then kind of got progressively more interested in behavior and kind of the mind itself, if you will, rather than the brain per se. And
now I'm going to stop you right there.
Yeah.
That is an interesting distinction, the mind versus
sure,
the brain.
Yeah.
What does that mean?
Well, I mean, a lot of people would say that they are the same. Certainly in the neurosciences, they'd say the mind is a product of the brain. And that may or may not be the case. It's kind of an area of active, not so much research, but debate, really. From my perspective, it's what I mean is something more methodological.
Okay.
That I just am more interested in thinking about how people behave or their inner experiences more than looking at the brain itself.
Okay.
And I'm interested in the brain to the extent that it might tell us something about our experiences, but less about it for its own sake, if you will.
So how are you defining mind?
You know, this is such a big kind of philosophical topic.
We're never going to get to anything else.
What I'm really thinking about it just in terms of the experience of having an experience, right? If you're
okay
right now, you're maybe someone's listening to this and hearing some voice and having their own thoughts, and that kind of inner process,
uh-huh,
to some extent a conscious process, but not necessarily.
Okay.
And I guess when I say I kind of drifted more toward the mind and behavior, it's really less from a kind of a philosophical or an ideological perspective, and more just that's what I wanted to be spending my time doing.
Sure.
It's
sure,
not really because of a, I wanted to plant a flag in a certain side of
right,
theological or philosophical
sure,
debate, but rather that's just what I wanted to be doing.
What interested you.
Yeah, what interested
yeah,
me, exactly. And so it was sort of a slow drift in that direction. I mean, a lot of, let's say what I teach at the college is effectively neuroscience, and I'm certainly interested in that, but
okay,
that's kind of, in terms of my research, I'm really less interested in topics related to the brain and more interested in behavior.
Okay.
So I got interested in vision I had an interest in visual art and was doing a lot of photography and that just kind of led me to an interest in how do we see things and why does the world look the way it does.
Yeah.
And
of course, again, that's really fascinating because, I mean, there would be people who could argue it's purely a physiological process, how we see the world, right? Uh-huh, but I hear you saying that you were looking more at the interactions of the what's going on in the brain, maybe, and more context, or I don't know. I mean,
yeah. Well, I guess it's more just that I'm not studying the brain per se. It's not okay. Not that I think it's not. I do think that process is happening in the brain, but I'm kind of interested in more exploring the lived experience of it.
Yeah.
So it's not that I would deny the role of the brain in supporting vision, and
sure,
it has a critical, really the main role. But that's kind of not what I wanted to focus on.
Yeah, so, right.
Anyway, so I got interested in faces at some point. I'm not sure exactly how. That would be hard to say. And that kind of led me to, at a certain point, I started, after I finished my PhD, I started a postdoc working in a laboratory that was studying prosopagnosia, which is sometimes called face blindness.
Oh, right.
So
okay.
Prosopagnosia coming from Greek roots for something like face ignorance.
Oh, okay.
And that was pretty interesting to me, studying these people who haven't. When I say these people, it's really, I'm sure, people who are listening right now, it's it turns out to be fairly common that a lot of people are just not good at recognizing faces. And when I say not recognizing them, I mean that they know who the person is but can't access that information from seeing their face.
Right.
So we, in extreme cases, we have people who maybe go to daycare and pick up the wrong children.
Oh, wow. Okay.
So they really, can't even recognize, people that their family members that they're living with. So
okay.
The people that they're the closest to. That's kind of an extreme case, but a lot of people are born this way, as far as we can tell.
Okay.
At least they never develop normal face recognition ability.
Okay.
And it's much more common than we realized until recently. Really, the internet has kind of fostered people getting together and kind of trading experiences, and the science kind of followed that community that built on the internet, sort of sharing experiences. And it now that there are a number of estimates that suggest maybe around 2%, approximately, depending on how you define the cutoff, could be considered face blind or are going to have real problems recognizing faces. It seems to be something, it's a bit like color blindness, in that unless you take a test for it, you may not know that you have poor face recognition.
Oh, sure. Okay.
Because it's not, who talks about how you recognize face?
Right.
It just kind of happens, right? We kind of assume that it's the same for everyone. It turns out it's not.
Right.
And, which I think is also interesting because it suggests that a lot of other aspects of our experience, including visual experience, these things that we sort of take for granted is just, a direct access to the world, that we're all seeing the same thing, and maybe that's not the case.
Right, that's very interesting. Do they know what the cause of it is?
Well, the short answer is no.
Okay.
It's still kind of an open,
it's a
pretty open area of research.
Okay.
We don't know.
I was thinking, even we were talking, or actually earlier when you came in, about have I seen you before? Should I recognize you? Right? When you're in a small town.
Yeah. Yeah.
But I was thinking about how, depending on who you are and kind of your your world, the kind of work and habits that you have. I would say for the majority of us. I mean, now maybe I'm overestimating, but we don't have to test it because we see people in the same kind of contexts. So, like we were saying, so I have a group of people that I see regularly on church on Sunday, and I recognize them there.
Yes, right.
Or I see somebody in a classroom, right? So I know they're my students. Yeah. But if I'm out on the battlefield running in the morning or something, I might see somebody in running, and think, wait a minute,
So that's when the face recognition is really tested, when you don't have the context.
Right.
Yeah.
Is that some of how they, how do you
absolutely
test for it?
Well, so when we're testing for it, we try to strip away all of that context.
Okay.
So we often teach people to recognize or try to recognize new faces.
Okay.
We don't give them any clothing or you know, we don't give them voices, we don't give them distinctive patterns of walking, we don't give them a context like, you know, you're at the dentist's office.
Right,
you
know, right, exactly.
And so that makes it really hard.
Yeah.
We even, you know, we take away the hair and, you know, that's that kind of thing that can be a distinguishing feature. People who can't recognize faces typically are fine at most of these other things.
Sure.
It's just that the face is particularly useful for identifying people, and so it's, if you're, you know, if you don't have that cue, then you're kind of sunk in these situations where the context is removed.
Right.
Yeah,
that's so interesting. Anyway, so you had started doing that work.
Yeah, and then through the course of this, well, the first time that we encountered someone who is the opposite, I tested someone who is a he was face blind, and he was describing a friend of his as being particularly good at recognizing faces. And my first thought was, well, of course you think that.
Yeah. You can't recognize anyone.
Everyone's a genius compared to you at recognizing faces. And I mean, that's actually a common thing that face blind people will say, you know, maybe my spouse is amazing
really
at faces.
Really good, yeah.
And it's, you know, usually they're good. I mean, they're sort of in the average kind of range. Yeah, but he had more to say about this guy that, you know, sort of specifics about the other person's experience. So I thought, well, okay, I'll go ahead and test him. And we brought him in, and he maxed out all of our tests that we had designed to distinguish, you know, sort of average from below average people. And we thought, well, he could be really good, but we're going to need to make new tests.
Oh, how interesting.
So we ended up coming up with at that time, a couple of new tests that we could use to test him, and then we ended up hearing from more people. We had some media publicity about prosopagnosia, and some people were just to say, well, I think I'm the opposite. Do you want to test me?
Everybody said, wants to be tested, yeah.
Sure. And it turned out they were really good. They were much better than average. And their descriptions of their experiences also were consistent with that.
Okay.
Describe things like being able to recognize people in, you know, in TV or movies from a non-speaking role in an advertisement that they've been in.
Oh, wow,
something,
right.
You know, really kind of extreme situations like that.
Yeah.
Which was interesting because it's the opposite of what we hear from face-blind, prosopagnosic people, is that they often don't really like watching TV or movies because they can't keep the characters straight.
Oh, I hadn't even thought about that. Sure.
Yeah.
Okay.
Huh. And so, you know, there were comments like that, or just that they would recognize people on the street that they'd, you know, seen briefly 10 years ago in some different context with a totally different hairstyle or things like that. You know, these are really kind of extreme situations. So there was both this high scoring on the test and also the really different descriptions of their experiences of recognizing people that made us think, well, this is something real here.
Yeah.
So that was when we published our first paper on it.
And you coined the term super recognizer, right?
I mean, did. Your team. That's right, yeah.
Isn't that great?
Yeah,
I love
that.
I mean, really, it hadn't been studied. People hadn't.
It was, it's interesting. It's hard to give a name to something.
That's just fabulous. So. What a neat thing to sort of. I was wondering, as you were talking about the kind of these extremes and back to kind of the normalizing of experience, we just assume whatever we have is normal. I wonder if this is true for all of the senses. Like I think about people with smell and taste, and I know, right, we all, they're quite extremes of that. And I was just, I think it's just,
well, it's funny you mention that. I'll have to give you some money later, because this term super recognizers actually took as kind of an homage to a phenomenon called super tasters.
Oh, really? Okay.
So it turns out some people are, it's a little bit, they're kind of different phenomena, but people who are called super tasters have more taste buds on their tongue, and they're more sensitive to certain kinds of taste experiences, like bitterness, for example. So people who are super tasters often are more sensitive to things like, well, maybe they dislike vegetables, or they dislike alcohol, or a variety, any sort of strong or bitter taste, they'll tend to avoid.
Oh, okay.
And there are some other distinctions as well related to the perception of bitterness. So some of the taste receptors for bitterness certain people don't have. This is actually something I demonstrated in one of the classes I teach.
Oh, okay.
And, you know, experience whether they taste this particular bitter taste.
Oh, that's
so
sweet.
I think probably there is this kind of variation in all the senses, as well as maybe, you know, non-sensory
differences as well. Yeah, that would be interesting, right?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah, yeah. I think this in psychology, the study of human differences, it's something that maybe for several decades has been a bit less of it outside of certain areas. So personality psychology, you've probably heard about different personality tests and so forth.
Oh, yeah.
And certainly with, let's say, yes, psychological disorders, that kind of, that would be an aspect of difference. But in terms of some of these, what we tend to think of as low-level or kind of basic aspects of our experience, it's kind of been assumed that, you know, we all see the world more or less the same, right? Or that we have the same style of thinking or that kind of thing. And,
right.
and recently, in the last maybe 10 years or so, there have been some cracks starting to appear in that notion. It seems as though there's actually more variation between us in terms of just these basic things like how the world looks to us than we realize. And it's not just color blindness or things like that, but there are even more subtle differences like our experience of faces. I mean, what a basic aspect of our experience of life is looking at other people that we know or don't know, and the, I mean, the face is such a rich source of information about who people are.
Does this mean also that people who are face blind, is it just that they can't recognize who the person is, or they also don't recognize like facial cues that would indicate emotion and things?
Right. As far as we can tell, they seem to be, you know, at least typically they're fine at all of those other aspects of, you know, information that we glean from the face.
It's like, just the recognition.
What kind of expression, emotional expression they have, or how old or young they are, the male or female, or that, you know, these kinds of things that sort of place a person in terms of demographic groups, they can do those and so forth.
One of the things that I think is so interesting about that, and I'm again really appreciating as I hear you talk, is one of the things that we talk about up here a fair amount is theology and disability, right? And I think, you know, for a long time, the kind of operating definition of you know, of a disability is, you know, everyone is sort of able in the same way, and then if you deviate from that, it's a disability, and it's seen as a problem, and it's, you know, rather than recognizing that we're sort of all on a spectrum of ability and, and disability in different ways. And so I think I'm always kind of encouraged to hear about these distinctions, because you know, things that we wouldn't maybe aren't officially labeled a disability by the ADA, but still indicate these differences that are, do mean that we engage in the world in different ways and have different challenges, or, you know, and I just think it's a helpful reminder that there's not a normal, you know, right? We just sometimes think that there's kind of a normal. It's more complicated than that, I think.
Yeah, I mean, who would have guessed that there is a spectrum of ability to recognize faces?
Right,
I mean, if we find this, what other kinds of abilities are going to turn out to be on a spectrum as well.
Right, right, yeah, exactly. Well, tell me a little bit, we had said, again, we had talked, and this isn't exactly the work that you're doing now. You've kind of moved into another related area, sort of, or what?
So I'm now still working on how we perceive people from the face, but I'm looking at some of these other kinds of perceptions that we make about people, like, how healthy do they look?
Yeah.
Or, you know, or is this a man or a woman? Or are they older or younger? Or that kind of thing. Because it turns out that there's really a lot. I mean, if you reflect on it, when you're looking at someone, you kind of, not only do you perhaps know who they are if you've seen them before, but you have a lot of information about them.
Oh, yeah.
And I think that's part of why we, you know, this notion of face-to-face communication. Of course, that's emotional, and I'm not really looking at that so much. A lot of people are doing that, but I'm not. But even these other kinds of things, right? We can tell when someone is, you know, hasn't slept well.
Right.
Or all that kind
of thing. Or stressed or happy or...
Exactly.
So, and does this also relate to what we find attractive, what we find appealing? Is that... you doing any of that work either?
So I'm also looking at that. Why, you know, what are the factors that make faces look more or less attractive? This is something that maybe 30 years ago it was thought, certainly by everyone in psychology, and I think in the culture at large, that there you know, beauty was in the eye of the beholder, that we all had our own preferences. And I could, you know, I could study your preferences, but that would only tell me about you. It wouldn't tell me anything about me or, you know, the person down the street or anyone else. And and that's really been, we don't think that anymore because of a couple of lines of evidence. The main one being that there have been studies by anthropologists showing that if you take, you know, pictures of faces, different kinds of faces, different, let's say, demographic groups, different racial, ethnic groups, around to different cultural groups, and you ask them, you know, who's attractive or who's more or less attractive, they have a fair amount of agreement with with everyone. You know, like, so your preferences would be similar to someone, not the same, but that there's a degree of similarity with, say, someone in Japan or someone in, you know, a hunter-gatherer in the Amazon, or, you know, sort of a real wide variety of people. And so it suggests that actually there is some, at least some degree of universal agreement about what makes faces more or less attractive. And so that sort of led people to ask, well, what is it?
And there are some people who have a stake in that, right?
Some people, there are some people.
Plastic surgeons.
Makeup companies.
Are
interested in that question and, you know, would like to profit off of it, of course. And I think it's a really interesting question. It's a, that's such a, I mean, you know, I think if we're honest with ourselves, all of us are interested, you know, concerned with that to some degree. Maybe not want to be, but but it's there. And I think that that points to something interesting about
about us. Think so too. I mean, again, we also talk about here, I mean, this is you know, with it kind of there's three sort of classic attributes of God, you know, the true, the good, and the beautiful, right? And so this whole category of kind of theological aesthetics. But I think we live in a culture today where I would have thought before, you know, we just had this conversation that we have a very, frankly, a fairly narrow appreciation, at least for women, and I'm sure it's true for men too, of what's beautiful. You know, you tall, thin, blonde, a certain kind of a certain facial cheekbones, smile, you know, whatever. And so, and when you think about it that way, then of course you think about how race plays into that and all of, and what it means to be considered beautiful versus considered ugly. I know that there have been studies, people who are deemed beautiful make more money, they, you know, and so, so to think about, you know, what's, how much of this is societal and is some of it genetic, or I mean, it's really, it's pretty fascinating, I think.
Those basic questions about the why, I think, is what, you know, you're to some extent getting at there, and a lot of that's still a bit up in the air. I mean, we've done a pretty good with establishing a set of empirical facts about agreement, and what do we agree about and not agree about, or when do we agree or disagree, but the reason for those preferences is less clear.
Okay.
You know, there are different ideas about it. And certainly the role of culture and society in shaping those preferences. Again, talking really just about visual preferences. So certainly, you know, a deeper sense of beauty or let's say a non-physical sense of beauty. I'm not even talking about that. I'm just talking about the superficial kind of beauty.
Right.
Even that, though, is there certainly is a role for culture and teaching for that. And that's a lot of the work now. That's something I'm interested in as well. You know, in what aspects of beauty or in what situations do these sort of more universal factors play a role, and how are they shaped or you know, guided by culture?
Well, in the little time we have left, I mean, what are some of the I mean, bigger questions would you say that you like? I'm, you know, I had said before we had started the kind of so what about the work that you're doing. What do you find really kind of engaging, challenging, fulfilling when you think about the broader ramifications of what you're doing?
Yeah, well, I guess, I mean, if we're just thinking about the work with, say, the superrecognizers and the prosopagnosics, I think being aware of this variety of difference is important. And it's important certainly for those of us who are, you know, further away from the average, you know, on this ability. It's often really gratifying just to be aware of of it, right? We're not crazy. A lot of, especially for people who are prosopagnosic, sometimes they really are made to think that there's something wrong with them or they're, you know, that they don't like people or something like that. And,
yeah.
And there's something that they just can't put their finger on that's a little off in how they interact with people. And it's really gratifying to learn that, you know, they have sort of a visual difference.
Yeah.
I think in terms of the work on beauty, I mean, I'm very interested in makeup and other systems that we have for beautification.
Uh-huh.
We put a lot of energy into this. It's something that we're doing.
Yes, we do.
We're all interested in it.
Yeah.
And we're all interested in around the world in this.
Yep.
There are interesting differences and similarities in how people do this. And I think this is an area where we're going to, you know, in my lifetime, we're going to be able to see a growth in how we understand that I think important aspect of our lives. And so that's exciting to me to potentially be a part of that kind of growth of awareness.
Well, are you, I don't want to say it as baldly as like pro or anti makeup, but what do you, I mean, when you think, I don't know if you're married, if you have children, or if you think about daughters or what you, I mean, what do you think, what's healthy about using makeup or not healthy? Or do you think about it that way? Or
absolutely.
This is a conversation I didn't think I'd be having with you, just so you know.
I don't usually get asked that quite so directly or personally. I think, you know, maybe science journalism tends to be less interested in the personal, right? And so, but it's of course, it's interesting to me. I think, like a lot of men, I think that's something that I had kind of a negative association with. You'll often ask men, you know, how do you like makeup? And there's a sense of deception or something like that.
Okay,
there's sort of a lie. Combined with maybe some sense of, you know, a dislike for vanity or feeling like, we shouldn't be too concerned with our appearance, kind of thing. I think the more that I've studied it, the I like it more. I have much more of a, at this point, kind of a neutral feeling about it. Maybe because I spend a lot of time thinking about it, but I also don't wear it myself. So it's. I think that sense that a lot of men have of not liking it is also tempered by the fact that in many ways men do like makeup. They just often aren't aware of how many women wear.
You have no idea how much goes into the natural look, let me just tell you.
I'd love to,
this is so funny.
If this weren't radio, then I'd show a picture kind of illustrating this.
Right.
But, I mean, it's a lot of, I had a roommate when I was in grad school who had a girlfriend. He was telling me once about things he liked about her, and one of them was that she didn't wear makeup. Of course, she actually did wear makeup, but it was, like you say, it was the natural look, and he wasn't aware of it.
But she
definitely wore makeup.
Right.
And I think that's a real common...
Yeah.
That's real common for a lot of men. So, I mean, you're asking about my experience, and it's sort of, as someone who, you know, is a man in our culture, I don't...
It
would be unusual for me to actually wear makeup.
Right.
So it's sort of this kind of reaction to others, right?
But it's not in other cultures, I imagine, for men. I mean, they probably wouldn't call it makeup the way we think about makeup now, although I do think there are some cultures where it's more typical for men to wear, I don't know, a little foundation or a little
eyeliner. Sure, even in our, you know, certainly in maybe not quite the U.S., but in Western culture, it was common a few hundred years ago.
Oh, sure, of
course.
There was
smallpox, right, for men to wear foundation quite heavily and so forth. And we could look at other examples, you know, ancient Egyptians wearing the kohl eyeliner.
Yeah.
This was something that not only men but also children would wear this.
Yeah.
Now, both of those cases, there was a kind of a medical reason, or in the case of smallpox, it wasn't medical so much as there was a sort of, you know, horrible scarring that people wanted to cover over.
Sure.
And it's thought that the kohl that ancient Egyptians wore had some antiseptic property related to the floods of the Nile. My sense is that overall it's less common, if we're looking cross-culturally, for men to wear makeup in the style that, for example, we see, you know, here in Gettysburg or in not only in the West, but really throughout the industrialized world. So also in East Asia or South Asia or other you know, urban center, any place you could take an airplane to, let's say. You're going to see typically women, but not men, making their eyes and lips darker.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, you don't see
Men don't do
that. They're not darkening the nose or some other part of the face. It's these specific parts of the faces. Right. And this, I think, is not an accident. You don't see men doing that, and part of it's because it actually accentuates a feature that is, there's a sex difference in it.
And
so male and female faces have a naturally occurring sex difference. There's more contrast around the facial features in women than in men.
What's the eye difference in men and women?
Yeah, so it's what actually differs, it turns out, is the skin.
Oh.
So women have lighter skin than men.
Just in general. Really?
This is something that we're really... Generally, I wasn't aware of until I started studying this, but there's a lot of data around the world, and every sort of racial and ethnic group that's been studied, you see this difference, but it's fairly small.
Okay.
So female skin, on average, and again, this is on average, will reflect about 2-3% more light
than
male skin does. But it's a much smaller difference than... say between different racial groups, it might be as much as 30%. If you're looking at
dark, light. Yeah.
So, in the sort of modern world, when we think about skin color differences, we immediately think about race.
Right. Of course.
Right? And we're really not even that aware of sex differences. But if we look at more racially homogeneous populations, then you find knowledge of the sex difference. So, for example, the English language expression "the fairer sex."
Oh.
To refer to women, now it has this sort of metaphorical quality.
Right,
it's originally
just
akin to calling women the lighter sex.
Really?
Huh. And so my thought is that this is because now there's so much more difference that's explained by race in terms of skin color than sex difference. So we're not consciously aware of the sex difference, but our perception, our brain is aware of it because we're used to looking at lots of faces, and it's not large enough to be consciously aware of.
Hmm.
It turns out the eyes and the lips are not, there's not much of a sex difference.
Oh.
And so this is why there's more contrast between the lips and the surrounding skin, or the eyes and the surrounding skin.
Oh.
And the way the visual system works, we kind of see the world in terms of contrast.
Yeah.
So beginning at the level of our eye, Our nervous system is kind of throwing away information about absolute luminance in favor of contrast information.
Okay.
This is the reason why, you need a... Those of us who are old enough to have done, sort of manual photography, you need a light meter.
Okay.
In order to get the exposure right. Because our eye, it basically throws that information away.
We can't tell
how much sort of light is reflecting off of a surface, but we can tell how much contrast there is between adjacent regions, between the eye and the surrounding skin.
Huh. Yeah. So what you're saying is inherently contrast is noticeable or even appealing, and so women accentuate this contrast.
Exactly.
Okay.
Yeah. And so I think that's a part of why makeup is worn the way it is, it's accentuating a naturally occurring sex difference.
Okay.
And it turns out, and we don't totally understand why, but these exaggerated sex differences are considered more attractive.
Okay.
So, for example, if I had, if I have people rate how feminine a bunch of faces, female faces look, and maybe another group of people rate how attractive each of them are, we'll see a strong relationship, a correlation between those ratings.
Okay.
Again, we're not sure why. There are different ideas about it, but it's a quite robust finding.
Yeah. Well, it's very fascinating. I mean, again, we could have a long conversation because, of course, you're right. I mean, I think for many people, makeup is associated with vanity, and certainly in the church, right? I mean, you have some pious Christians who don't want to wear makeup, who feel like that's, again, it's the face painting, right? We use that line in a negative sort of sense. And I think, when I think about women, my own experience, my friend's experience, I mean, for many of us, and I include myself in this category, I just find it a lot of fun, right? I love the color. I like to play with it. I think it's enjoyable. I paint my nails. I do all of it. I think it's great,
It's kind of an aspect of your personality.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
In a visual way.
Right. Yeah. But I think there's also the negative of that is I think there is a lot for a lot of women. They do feel a lot of pressure, right? And so you feel like you do have to look a certain way. And I don't know if you've done any correlations, the selfie culture and this kind of pressure of looking.
Yeah.
So it's, you in some ways, I think it's, to hear you talk, reminds me that it I don't know if I want to say it's natural. I mean, I'm sort of wrestling just how I would even want to categorize this, but it's not simply vanity, or it's not simply, there's much more going on, and it doesn't have to be kind of an inherently, I think some people think it's sort of inherently a negative thing. I don't know, that's so interesting.
Yeah, and yet it's something that it's so hard to, I mean, it's there in each of us, this sort
sure.
of urge to be attractive.
Sure.
To, you know, to notice, you know, others as, you know, in aesthetic ways.
Yeah,
or
right,
of attractiveness.
Of course.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it, well, yeah.
Well, and again, it's also, I mean, just going back to what you said earlier, just how we view the world, I mean, how we see, right? I mean, that has such, so many layers of meaning. I mean, how we see ourselves, how we see others, how we see ourselves in relationship to others, right? Because I think a lot of that, you can have a context, a group, a situation where everyone, this is sort of the norm, but then you go into another place and this is the norm. And
right.
so suddenly what
yeah,
was normal
absolutely.
Behavior in one context is
yeah.
not in another, and
yeah,
how that sort of works. Do you find that... that certain colors are more appealing than other colors? Is there, and does that correlate to anything natural or a sex difference or anything like that?
In terms
either,
of like
or?
Say colors of lipsticks,
yeah,
eyeshadow,
right.
that,
yep,
that kind
yep.
of thing. Yeah, you know, I haven't. This it's a question that really interests me, but I haven't actually done any research
okay.
quite at that
okay.
level of specificity.
Okay.
I mean, I think that's certainly one place that this kind of research could go is toward, you know, guiding development of makeup or making it, you know,
sure.
perfect for certain skin tones, or as we, you know, say as we get older, how should our makeup change because
sure.
our face is changing or
yeah.
you know, all of this kind
Women's
of thing.
Women's magazines are full
yeah.
of that information,
right? yeah.
just so you know. It
yeah.
may not be based on your science,
yeah.
but they're full of it.
Yeah.
Yeah. Oh, how interesting. Well, this was just a great conversation, and I didn't even tell you. I mean, my work is in systematic theology, which is kind of looking at how we think about God and ourselves and the world and all of that kind of together. And I always tease my students because I always want to say the great thing about being a theologian is that absolutely everything is in your purview,
uh-huh,
right?
Yeah.
And just and I would not have thought it in terms of this conversation, but like you said, the way that we see ourselves and view difference in others and difference in ourselves, I mean, that really does matter, right? How
yeah.
we, what we think about as being normal and all of that.
Yeah.
And so that's,
yeah.
you've really given me a lot to think about. So that's
okay.
been a lot of fun. So, yeah.
Thanks. Well, I've enjoyed it too.
So again, our guest was Richard Russell, Associate Professor of Psychology at Gettysburg College. And just a delight to talk with you this afternoon.
Great. Thanks for talking to you.
Thank
Chris.
You.
You have been listening to The Seminary Explores from historic Seminary Ridge in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania, a production of Gettysburg Seminary. We invite you to visit our website at www.ltsg.edu. Opinions expressed on this program are not necessarily those of Gettysburg Seminary or the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America.